This morning's Dhamma talk. I always aim to keep these talks on meditation, teaching people, helping people, leading people on the path to find out for themselves, instead of telling you what to believe. And one of the reasons is if we just use theories and dogmas and ideas, which, you know, let's say, I am right and everyone else is wrong, all we do there is get lots of arguments. So we never solve the problems of life, nor do we solve the problems inside ourselves by thinking. It's much more like experiencing, and even like by feeling, by getting to know the emotional world. And to be able to get that, you have to learn how to be still, to calm the thoughts down. So already, the last couple of days, people have pointed out something which, you know, is to be expected. The biggest problem for meditation is not just finding a quiet place to sit or getting a comfortable body. Those things could be solved pretty easily. Just, you know, getting a nice chair or just meditating in your bed, you know, on top of the bed in your room, or just finding a nice place in the forest to meditate. All those things are just need a little bit of arrangement here, just an adjustment there. But of course, the hardest thing to do is, you may be very quiet, but to be able to, you know, outside, but to be able to take that peace and stillness inside your mind, so you're not thinking too much. And of course, you all know in our modern world, the thinking is what is just really goes over the top, and we can't stop it. And it causes huge amounts of problems for people. So, an example of that is, and it ties into what I was saying yesterday about stillness allowing things to disappear and vanish. When we first came to Australia 33, 34 years ago, I was with the other monk who was senior to me, Ajahn Jacaro. And we'd only been in a little house in Magnolia Street in North Perth a few weeks when somebody came and said, you know, that here you're Buddhist monks, meditators, would you like to try out the sensory deprivation chamber, the flotation tank? And those flotation tanks were just this little sort of, you know, tank, and inside the tank there was salt water, and it was at body temperature, so you just float in it, you know, without sort of being submerged. It was the same density as a body, or a little bit more dense, so you just floated on the surface. Imagine that. No sore bum, no sore tailbone, no legs aching, no aches at all. It was at body temperature, so you never felt hot, you never felt cold. It was airtight. But they must have had some sort of oxygen going through there. But I mean, soundproof, so you couldn't hear any sounds from outside. It was perfectly dark, so you couldn't see any light. And so I thought, wow, this is absolutely perfect. You have to get into jhana in such a place because there's no impingements on you at all. And of course, we have things like seniority and hierarchy, unfortunately. So Ajahn Chako got the first try in this flotation chamber. You know, just he had to get some bathers from somebody and just go in the tank and just float. You know, there's a good supply of oxygen, there's soundproof, airproof, lightproof, and no problems with his body at all. Just perfectly relaxed, floating in a warm, salty water solution. And I was really looking forward to my go in there. I was going to go the next day. The trouble with looking forward and expectations. Every time I've had an expectation, it always comes back to bite me. So, what happened was the next morning, somebody brought a newspaper to us, the local paper, West Australian, where there was a big advertisement. Flotation chambers, as used by Buddhist monks. They'd exploited us. We couldn't argue against it because he'd invited in there to give it a try, just for an experiment, see what it was like. But he used us, you know, to advertise his product to get more people to buy into it. So because that was unethical, you know, he said I couldn't go into it, I couldn't give it a try. And I thought, well, it's, you know, the damage has already been done. So no, let me go in there, I want to give it a try, but no. So I never got to have a try in the flotation tank. But anyway, I asked him, what was it like in there? It must have been just so easy to get into deep meditation. And he's just sitting there, or not even sitting there, just lying there, just no aches and pains at all. No one coughing or rustling or going oi or whatever, no noise. It was just so beautiful. And he said, well, you know, you couldn't see anything, you couldn't feel anything in the body, but you could certainly hear his breath and also the thoughts which go in the mind. And so following those sensory deprivation chambers, these days, I don't think they're very popular anymore, but they used to, the only way they could get people to relax is because, yeah, you can actually calm down most of the body functions except for the breathing, but also the thoughts. Many executives, they had to play a video in there, like a golf video or something. Otherwise, they'd be thinking all the time. And it reminded me that when are the times when human beings in our modern society can actually stop thinking? You know, one of those times is when you're listening to, say, great music, or you're watching a movie, or somehow or other you are entertained by something outside of yourself. Because that's what they had to do in these sensory deprivation chambers. Do something, whether it's a music or sounds of nature or something, to overcome the thinking. Because otherwise you'd be sitting in there thinking, fantasizing, whatever it is, something to fill up a space which you're not used to and you're not comfortable with, the space of silence. So it is part of our modern world that we are conditioned, taught, encouraged to think so much that we've lost the art of being silent and just being. We're always going somewhere, doing something, thinking something, working out problems. So already that just those little sensory deprivation chambers actually show that most people, they need something else just to block out the thoughts. And that was one of the reasons why that they had things like nature sounds. Now nature sounds you can hear all the time, you know, over in this forest. And those, the sound of the birds, just about hear them. The sound of the wind in the trees. But you have to be to a certain level of peace to be able to notice those. And the same with the beautiful views, just now by the stupa, just over the forest, out to the horizon, where we have the Indian Ocean. So there's beautiful views in this this compound, which you can watch. But you'll find, unless it's your a certain degree of silence, a certain degree of peace, you'll find you'll be watching those that sunset, thinking about all the things you're going to do in your business when you go home. All the stuff you're going to do. In other words, it's not strong enough to actually to calm down the thinking mind. Which is a big problem. And you try to do buddho buddho, or you try to do namo buddhaya, or something else, and in the end it just doesn't work, it's just too much effort, you get tired. So what is the solution so that you can have a nice peaceful mind? And again you go back to similes of like water. The waves on the water, if you go down by the lake, down here, when you look at that lake, there are nearly always these ripples or waves on the surface. It's great if it's perfectly still. But where do those waves come from? Those waves aren't an inherent part of the lake. It means something's agitating it. Something is making it move. And of course, once it's made to move once, it keeps on vibrating, or the waves keep on going for, you know, quite a few minutes afterwards. So the lake isn't naturally moving. Its nature, its default state, as they say, is to be perfectly still and smooth. It's only something outside of it makes it move. And this is one of the great insights of the Buddha. The thing which makes it move is wanting. The wind of wanting stirs up the surface of the lake and creates the waves. And in that simile, the waves are your thoughts. The nature of the mind is actually still, believe it or not, but we're not used to that natural state of mind. We're always going things and doing things. And it's the wanting creates the thoughts. Even wanting good things, let alone wanting bad things, it agitates the mind. Now, if you know the problem, the wanting, it's just basic second noble truth. Craving is a cause for suffering. Wanting stuff. And it's very easy to see that after a while. Whenever you want something, you are separated from where you want to be. And that was one of the Buddha's descriptions of the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Separated from where you want to be. And the solution, and I love doing this because it's visual. Instead of just listening, you actually have to look as well. Use more of your senses and get the message across. This woman some time ago, she came up to me, I think it was in Nonamara Temple, and she was so upset. And she said, oh, I'm just having such a hard time in my life. And she used a visual metaphor. She said, this is where I am in my life. My career, my family, my spiritual life, I'm down here. And this is where I know I need to be. Up here. Now, this is where I need to be, and this is where I am. And it's just so hard to bring myself. I get up a little bit and I go down again. I know I should be up here. I get up and then somebody gets in the way and it pushes me down again. It's so much suffering. Help. And of course, the solution was obvious. You know, he said, if this is where you are and this is where you want to be, it's just so much suffering trying to get up to where you want to be. How about loving where you want to be to where you are? Problem solved. I don't know why people can't think about that, because they have all these ideas, expectations. I'm a nun, I should get jhana by now. I have been coming to this temple for so long, I should be able to fly through the air. I shouldn't need to go back home to Thai Airways. I should be just so wise and so enlightened. This is where you know you should be. This is actually where you really are. You to keep trying to push yourself up to where you want to be. That's wanting. Be content where you are. But Ajahn Brahm, that's not getting anywhere. Exactly. In life, we always want to get somewhere. We have these goals, aspirations, trying to get places. Oh, cheapest. You try that. You tried that in your material life, trying to get on in life. Try to prove yourself. Try to get the big house, the nice car, the lots of money in the bank. The holidays, the boats, the stuff in the bank. Have you got there yet? No. This is really tough and you work really hard. So instead, you try to build, become a monk or a nun, try to build the perfect monasteries. I was saying this last Wednesday night. You wouldn't believe how much effort I put in to build that monastery over there. I was doing it, do it once, do it well, and then you can relax. And I did it well, did it really planned out, a lot of work, and then the new monks come saying, oh, we don't want it that way, we want to do it this way. So they knock it all down and start all over again. If that doesn't happen, you get too many monks and they've got to build another monastery somewhere. And that's more headaches. It never stops. The material world, it's never good enough. There's always another extension to put on your house. If it's not upsizing, it's downsizing or side-sizing, I don't know. But it's always doing something there. And it's the same with your spiritual life. okay, I managed to do an hour last time. Now I'm going to do an hour and a half. Yeah, I got to the beautiful place last time. A lot of work, but I got there. Nimitus this time, nimitus. I'm not making any progress. What's happening? Sadhu, sadhu, you're not making any progress. Great. Sadhu, sadhu. Why do you always measure ourselves in progress? That is the problem. That is the wanting. Just a little word, measuring. I was a scientist, still am a scientist, but this person once asked me a question. I don't know why they asked me this question, but thank you for asking it from me, because they mentioned a quote from one of the well-known scientists, a fellow called Lord Kelvin. I think he was the first president of the Royal Society in London, the oldest, most prestigious scientific society in the world. And that he was, many people know him, the Kelvin scale of temperature. And it was like a rational scale, you know, starting at absolute zero. And what was it, 272 was the freezing point. So anyway, that was the Kelvin scale of temperature. But he also was a philosopher as well, as many people in science. It was called natural philosophy. And so he made a very good insight, which was important. It was crucial to the start of the Industrial Revolution, to the start of technology. He said, if you want to control nature, you have to learn how to measure her accurately, first of all. Measurement was crucial in the early days of industry and technology. The more accurate your measurement, the more you could actually control nature. So we had all these standard meter rules, cesium clocks, which could measure time totally accurately, and standard weights and measures, so we could measure things. And that's where we got control from. And you can see this is our modern world. But you also notice that there's a resistance, you know, to measuring, which is why many people resist ID cards or get very upset that Google knows exactly where you are right now. Or Facebook or whatever, because it has all your data. So people, this is just Big Brother control by measuring you, locating you. But when they asked me what I thought of all that, you know, that a lot of time insight's been looking at it from a different way, a different angle, a different way of perceiving is a great way of getting insights. So I said, well, what happens if we don't measure? If you don't measure, you can't control. It's one of my problems. A few weeks ago, I applied, you know, through Centrelink for a seniors card, a Commonwealth seniors card. I thought it was easy. I'm 66 now, 65. I think 60 you can get a seniors card here in Australia. And they asked me, what do you want a seniors card for anyway, Ajahn Brahm? You don't get a pension. I already get Meals on Wheels every day. You can figure that one out. And I thought, just to get a bit of respect for senior. But it was so difficult. Because I had to prove who I was. And I couldn't do that over the phone. I had to go to the local office to prove my identity, to be measured. And they said, okay, let's see your driving license. I ain't got that. Marriage license? Nope. Your bank account? No. Credit card? No. What else did they ask for? Sorry, marriage license. So much stuff you don't have. Oh, your rental agreement or your mortgage, your ownership of your house. There's so much stuff, or even your mobile phone. I don't have a mobile phone. So much stuff which measures you, I didn't have. And it was really difficult. And even today, I had to send off another form because they didn't accept the first one. when they ask you, Sajjan Brahm, can you prove who you are? And I said, I've been trying to do that for the last 43 years. And you expect me to do it just in 5 minutes? Well, anyways, now, this is serious. If you don't measure, you can't control. You have to let it be, which is the opposite of controlling. So, how's your meditation today? Stop it. Stop measuring and saying, oh, my meditation's terrible. Oh, my meditation's really good. Oh, my meditation's hopeless. As soon as you measure, then you have some business to be done. And a lot of times when we measure, unless it's absolutely perfect, unless your last meditation has been jhanas with all the lights and the jail bells and jingles and stuff, then you say, oh, it's not good enough, I can do better. So this is a wonderful thing when we meditate without measuring. When you don't measure, you've got nothing to think about. When you've got nothing to think about, you get silent. As soon as you measure, unfortunately many of us, we've been schooled, conditioned to measure and measure and measure. And we always do that. We measure the people sitting next to us. He's hopeless. He thinks he's meditating. Look, he's sleeping. He's snoring most of the time. And her, oh my goodness, she's always moving around. She thinks she's meditating, but I know I can hear her snoring. Whatever it is, how many times when we always measure with negativity. Always finding fault with ourselves and with others. That's the two bad bits in the world, which is a nice segue to... this is the two bad bits in the wall. The two bad bits in the wall, look, this creates thoughts. Understanding it stops thoughts because you don't measure anymore. So the two bad bricks on the wall, as I mentioned, first came here, didn't have any money, but actually we were in debt, I'll put it aside. You know, when we went to Magnolia Street, I looked in the accounts because I was good at math. I like doing sums. And I looked in the accounts and we had the house there. We owed $49,000. No, that's right. The house, we owed $50,000 for the house in Port Magnolia Street. No, it's actually worth $50,000. We owed $49,000. Our equity, all we were worth was $1,000. That was all. If we could sell it at market price, that was. So, you know, we had no money at all. And we decided to buy a monastery. Now, we didn't have any cash there. So we're in debt up to our necks, both of us. And so that we couldn't, there's no way we could get a builder to do anything for us. So we actually decided to build it ourselves. And you know you may have seen him the other day, just before he came here, Peter Zimdow, he was the plumber in the old days. It's amazing, all these people who helped us in the early days, they still keep on coming up now. They're our friends, they're almost like family. It's great when you get sort of a worker and you're kind to them, they're kind back to you, and we have a great time together. So anyway, one of the things I had to do was build a wall, brick wall. Easy. Yeah. Look, I had a good degree in theoretical physics from a really good university. I could do anything. That's the arrogance you get from degrees. If they can do it, I can do it. So conceited. And of course, it's not as easy as it looks. It looks easy, it is much harder than it looks. Put some mortar down, bung the brick on top, tap this, tap that, finish, go on to the next one. Money for nothing. But you try. That brick is never level. One end is always high, so you tap it down. And then the other end comes up. Sometimes you look it up and there's one of these honky nuts from the trees underneath. That's why it doesn't work. Or sometimes you find out and the cat has pooed in the sand, so the bleh underneath that. That happens. So you tap it down, another end goes up, you take out the cat poo and just pop a mortar, bang it down here, there. It takes forever. And then it's level, but then it's out of line. So you put it in line again, then it's not level again. It is so time consuming. Those bricks, they don't want to be level. They've got a will of their own. So, it was so time consuming. But I had time. In those days, I had nothing else to do. No teaching, no counseling, no committee meetings, no internet. I had all the time I wanted just to put a brick here, a brick there, doesn't matter how long. I wasn't being paid anyway, so who cares? So, I finished my wall. I did it. And I looked at that wall and, oh no! Have you ever done something and you find it's all messed up? The two bricks were crooked. And I don't know how that could have happened, how I could have missed that. I was so careful. And when I saw those two crooked bricks, I was devastated because they spoiled the whole wall, my first creation, my first masterpiece. And it was ruined. So what do? You try and scrape those mortar out. But the cement is really hard. It's like stone. Crikey, I can't get it out that way, so what should I do? So I had this wonderful idea, great insight. I asked the other monk, Ajahn Chah, it doesn't cost all that much to get some dynamite. Let's blow up the wall, because I can blow it up and start again. No, you can't. And so I was stuck with that wall for 3 months. I think it was about 3 months, I think. And I would have nightmares. Honestly, I'd wake up in the middle of the night in a sweat. I'd just been dreaming about these stupid bricks which would ruin the whole wall. And also, every time, I couldn't look at that wall. I always made a big detour, and especially when visitors were coming. In those days, we needed donations, and so if I took a visitor and they saw how I wasted their donations, they would never give anything. So I took them always somewhere else, the beautiful trees and the lovely plants, but not my wall. And so I was so ashamed. Until one day somebody came and they saw that wall and they said, that's a beautiful wall. I say, are you crazy? Are you blind? Can't you see those two bad bricks? And that's, as you know the story, they said, yes, I can see the two mistakes, but I can also see the 998 good bricks as well. And that literally hit me like a brick. Like two bricks. I was the blind one. It was me who was blind. Because I could never see anything else except my faults. I was a perfectionist. Had two little faults spoiled the whole wall. So much so, I wanted to destroy it, to blow it up. So many times you have a relationship, your husband, your wife, two bad things, that's it, divorced. You have yourself, you know, something, a mistake you make, say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, and you want to just destroy it. That's one of the great reasons for suicide. One or two bad things in your life, and you want to blow yourself up. That's one of the reasons. One bad meditation today, and you think, nah, I can't meditate. Give it up. I can't do this. You're missing the point. Just focusing on one or two bad things, because you've been trying for years to get into jhanas. You can only get first jhana, you can't move to second, no, so you're going to blow up the whole wall. No, that doesn't work that way. When you look at the whole wall, you see it's 998 good bricks, two bad bricks, your life, you're doing lots of good karma. Give yourself a break. It takes time to get enlightened. Anuruddha, one of the great disciples of the Buddha, 17 years before he became a stream winner. 17, and he was a cousin of the Buddha. And you think you can get enlightened after 9 days, you arrogant, conceited? So anyway, just be patient. You know, eons, how long is an eon? And hundreds of thousands, and the Buddha remembered, I mean, it was 96 or 97 eons of existence. So that's patience. So just take it easy. One of the nice things about being a Buddhist, doesn't matter if you don't get enlightened this life, you've got another life or one afterwards. Just relax, chill out, stop rushing around so much. And that's called the fast track. People think, the more I rush, the quicker I get there. Get where? To your grave, that's all. So instead, slow down, stop, and be here. That's the fast track. So anyway, so the two bad bricks in the wall, you realize that what somebody said afterwards when I told that cancer group, this bricklayer came along, it's actually a builder, he said, Ajahn Brahm, you don't have to worry at all about your mistakes. Even professional bricklayers, they keep making mistakes. And that's when he told me this wonderful ending to the story. He said, but I'll let you into a secret. Don't ever tell me secrets, because I just cannot keep them. They're just too much fun. I share them. And it's not just with you guys. This goes all over the world. And when all this stuff goes put on the internet, and some of these talks and stories get, with it, 3 million downloads or something, that really is not sharing at all. That's not keeping a secret, sorry. So anyway, the secret was, which is no longer a secret, he said, when we make a mistake in the building industry, we tell our clients it's a feature. No other house in Australia has got this. And because it's unique, we charge them an extra $5,000 for it. What a scam, but I think it's quite a nice scam. In a sense, so it just gives it more character. So all your mistakes in your meditation, wonderful. It's a feature of your meditation. In other words, we accept in people that we stop measuring it. And when we don't measure it, we can't control it. When we don't control it, we have to let it be. We can't want anything when we've got nothing to measure it by. So when we stop wanting, that's when the winds stop. And when the winds of wanting stop, because you can't measure it, you're just being here, you're not going anywhere. When the winds of wanting stop, then your mind gets calmer and calmer and calmer. Just like the bottle of water, it just gets really still. Now, what happens sometimes is as it gets more and more and more still, as you stop thinking less and less, first of all, we have the problem of fear. Ah, I'm not thinking anything. Because you know, I mean, many people in Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia say this. If you don't think, if you meditate, bad spirits will come into your mind and take over. You'll go crazy. Meditation is allowing the devil to come into your mind. People actually say that. So, well, you know, if the devil got into the Buddha's mind, that's pretty good. You know, Ajahn Brahm, I'm a pretty good guy. I'm kind. I don't go around killing people or hitting people. So, you know, that I meditate a lot. So no devil got into my mind. And all these other people, Ajahn Chah, he was amazingly brilliant and wise. And so he meditated a lot. So in other words, that's just fear. A lot of time it's the fear of the unknown. Fear of the unknown. When you first came in here the first night, you probably didn't sleep well. It always happens to me. When you go in a hotel, a new room, a new temple, you haven't slept there before. And that happens to me a lot, because I do travel around a lot. And the first night, you never have a good night's sleep, no matter how comfortable the bed, simply because, you know, it's new, and you don't feel as safe, as if it's your cave, your old place, you know that, you got used to it. It's just, you know, the nature of the mind and the body just gets a little bit tense. It's just where it can't let go all of its guards, just in case. So when you first in your room, in your cottage. Now, sometimes you don't really know. Who did Ajahn Brahm? Did he do a full psychological and police check on the person in the room next to you in your cottage? It's like, ooh, what's that sound? But after, you know, you get to know one another after a few days. Everybody's really kind and gentle and nice here. And so after a while, you can relax. You get to know each other. You get to know your room. You get to know the spiders. You get to know the little wriggly Portuguese millipedes on the path. You get to know the flies. Oh, they're fine. They're explorers. They just, you know, see an ear hole and they just want to find out what's inside of it. That's all. They've got no bad intention. They're just interested. In the end. So we get used to the place. When we get used to the place, we don't have any fear. We can relax. And that's those experiences. It's like you go to a new job. You go to meet a new person. Actually, who is this? So after a while, people relax. And it's the case, that's where I got this little three stages of anything new. First is recognizing, oh, it's just your room, it's just, you know, just this person, that person, it's just Bianca, it's just, you know, she, you know, you may not have met her before, she's a nice girl, great cook, and just so kind. So after a while, you know, who is she? And then you recognize, and then the next, after recognition, comes familiarity. You know, it's just like family, brother, sister. You're not afraid anymore. You recognize one another, and the recognition gets deeper so you can relax more until you get to the last stage, which is total ease with people. You're just a good friend, just like, you know, a best friend. You're totally at ease with them. You don't try and prove anything. You don't protect anything. You be with them, just like your room. First of all, you recognize it, get familiar with it, know how it works. And then you get familiar with it. It's like your own little place. And then it's at ease. It's like your own little home. So that's why some people, they come here and they always want to stay in the same room again. All rooms are the same, just about. But you want to stay in the same room because that's, you know, your room. You get too familiar with it. See your old room again. So the same happens with stages of peace and silence. What is silence anyway? Silence is very shy. If you say her name, she disappears. Obviously, when you say you're thinking, you're not silent anymore. So the inner silence, at first, people are a bit afraid of it. Because you're not used to it. How many places in this world can you be totally silent? There's no noise at all. It's so rare that it's really astounding if you can get into a situation where there's no noise at all, no sound. And, of course, one of those places that always comes to mind, when I went to the monastery in Sussex for the first time, maybe 40 years ago now, maybe, no, 35 years, 36 years ago. And I, really stupid, going in December, January time, worst time of all to visit UK. It's freezing over there. If you want to know how cold it is, just open the refrigerator and go and sit inside for an hour. That's what it was like. You should usually actually open the refrigerators up in the cold weather to warm up. That's how cold it is. It was minus 26 degrees centigrade outside. And look, this was not this place, another place. This monk said he made himself a hot cup of tea, you know, boiling water, hot cup of tea, you know, just warm himself up. He had to go to the toilet, first of all. So he just went to the toilet, just a number one, urination, only maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes. He came back, and the tea wasn't cold, it was ice. That's how quickly it frozen. That's really cold. But minus 26 degrees outside. So I decided to go out for a walk in the snow. And it was one of the best memories of my life. Still recall it. Because they used to say only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. This was the opposite. Only mad monks who are Englishmen go out in the snow when it's minus 26 degrees. But it was amazing. There was no animals around. Animals were just much smarter. They were all hibernating, cuddled up somewhere against the cold. There was no cars could actually drive because all the roads were icy. No aircraft because all the airports had closed down because of the heavy snow. And no one was around at all. No birds. Everything had stopped. And just me just walking in the silent, I mean, really was silent forest. There was no noise at all, except the crunch of the snow under my boots. And when I stopped walking, everything stopped. Silence. That was so amazing. It was so beautiful, so attractive, so profound, so meaningful. That was holy, the silence. That's why I just didn't want to move. I wanted to stand there and just soak it in as much as I could. You couldn't give it a name. You only give names to things, to noise, to disturbances. When things stop, the descriptions stop as well. Silence. No thoughts. No way could you capture that. You could not measure it. Stop, disappear. That was magic. So it's absolutely freezing, but so elated, enjoying the silence. And that gave you the respect, the lack of fear for silence. And instead, it got the distaste for thoughts, which were totally meaningless usually. All of the philosophers, what have ever they done except to argue and to confuse? But the silent sages, Santa Muni, that's what Santa means. It means silence, peaceful, calm. The real saints are not the people who go demonstrating and changing the world. They're the ones you never hear of. They're calm, they're peaceful. Silence. So, when you start to respect silence, when you start to even worship silence, find its worth, value it more than anything else, sometimes when silence comes, you welcome it, embrace it, and it stays with you, and you never disturb it. People have moments of silence. They chase it away because they think this can't be right, or they're not used to it, or they're afraid of it. There is a reason why you're afraid of silence, a very deep reason, and that is because when you're silent, you can't control it. You try and control it, and it vanishes. You've got to measure it to control it, say something about it. This is really silent. This is deeply silent. This is grade one silent. This is grade two silence. This is crazy. When you start measuring it and controlling it, of course it disappears. You really have to let it be. No control. And to be able to not control, that's where the controller, you, has to stop for a little while. You are the problem. The sense of self, your will, trying to control it, trying to do it, trying to keep it. And it all comes from your sense of self. All comes back again to ego, me meditating, I am the great meditator, I'm going to now hump this retreat, this next retreat, that was a good talk, I jump up, now I'm going to actually do it. Stop it. You can't do anything. How many years have you been meditating here? Where have you got? Nowhere. So stop it. You mean I'm not supposed to meditate? Meditate, but look, there is, I've still got it here. We used to have, I think it's still in the kitchen, we had this great cartoon. The person came to see the monk. It was actually a monk cartoon. And they had this big sign saying, I want happiness. Is that still in the kitchen? Don't think so. I don't know where it went to. Anyway, you get some of these really good cartoons sometimes. And it said, I want happiness, with a big sign. He's really miserable, very angry. And there was this monk sitting quietly as he came up to this monk. And the monk took the sign and said, first mistake, I. That's ego, sense of self. So he scrubbed out the I. And then the sign read, want happiness. Second mistake, wanting. So he scrubbed that out too. And then what's left? Happiness. And both of them smiled, and that was the end of the cartoon. That's really cool. Not messing around. I want happiness. I want jhanas. I want enlightenment. Whatever it is you want. The two problems there. Number one, I. Scrub that out. I'm fed up. I want this. I want that. The I's. That's where it starts from. Scrub that out. Then want happiness. You never get happiness if you have want before it. So, scrub out the want. That's the only thing left, happiness. When there's no I, there's no want, then you're happy. Give it a try. See what happens. So that was actually brilliant. That was really deep, one of the best cartoons I've seen. But anyway, stop measuring, stop wanting, and then you're just here. Well, I tried that, it doesn't work. What do you mean it doesn't work? It means you want something. You haven't really got it, you're still wanting something. That's a problem. And because you want, you think. So that's why when you're thinking, just think. Not you thinking, is it? What's the problem? I'm not supposed to think. Who said that? Oh, Buddha said that, you sure? Did you hear him from his own words or just read it somewhere? Maybe you misunderstood what it said. So it's dead. Just sit there. There's no one here. No one doing anything. So, thinking, if there's anything happening right now, we call that old karma. It's old karma because of what you did before. So now don't make any bad karma now. Just sit there. Just be. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Renounce, stop controlling. Be kind. Kind is not measuring. It's the unconditional part of awareness. The door of my heart is open no matter what you do, no matter who you are. It's the no matter what, the unconditional part of it, which makes it real compassion. It's not, I will love you as long as you behave. I will be kind to you as long as you give a big donation to all my projects. I will always spend lots of time with your interviews as long as you give me really nice cups of tea with condensed milk. Oh, that's not compassion and kindness. You know, when it's the strings attached. It's just when I will, whoever you are, no measuring, the kindness goes to everybody. Even to my stupid old mind. Stupid old mind. Ajahn Brahm, you know you work too hard. Oh, you keep on making two bad bricks. You keep on telling the same old bad jokes. Actually, there's a new joke here. Courtesy of Fresh gave it this morning. Really nice little joke. Bad jokes. An old man has 8 hairs on his head. He went to his barber shop. The barber, in anger, asked, shall I cut them or count them? And the old man smiled and said, colour them. I thought that was quite cool. Anyway, so stop measuring the jokes. You know, bad jokes, good jokes. You know, they're all bad. Get used to it. But stop controlling it. So you become at peace with yourself. With your non-self. And then after a while, because you don't want anything, you don't think. And think, oh yeah, you start not thinking, and at first all you know is dullness. Because you don't know what else it is. So just don't worry, it's Stop, don't disturb the dullness, stop measuring it. And little by little, when you start thinking, just, you know, it's uncertain, unsure, you haven't been there before, you don't really recognize it, you don't know what it is. Just like I used to love my favorite music was Jimi Hendrix. Really loud. And you know, my father used to let me play that Jimi Hendrix while I was doing my homework. And he said, you know, turn it off, concentrate on homework. I said, look, Dad, I get all top marks at school. I said, well, I don't understand this. Makes no sense to me. But if it works, carry on. So it's great if, you know, I could actually get, you know, get my father to buy me a new Jimi Hendrix record because it made my marks at school go up. I tell the kids that. And they kiss, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll try that with my parents. It worked for me, but I don't know if it worked for other people. But anyway, later on in life, you know, your taste in music changed. And I used to like classical music. Especially, you know, sometimes, you know, in the colleges of Cambridge, you'd be going somewhere and had some recitals. And it's incredible music, which is highly talented, you know, even students or music scholars would play. And you just stop and listen to it for, you know, half an hour and just amazing stuff. So beautiful. So my taste in music got more refined. And then there was the chamber music. Now, even some of the choral stuff, Monteverdi, was the last one which was my favorite before I sort of became a monk. And then afterwards, you started to listen to the sound of the wind in the trees, which was much better than any choral music. And then afterwards, when even the sound of the wind in the trees stopped, my favorite music became when nothing was moving at all, like in that forest or in the deep caves I used to hang out in. So silent that even sound vanished. That was the most wonderful music I've ever heard, when sound stops. So that is actually where you learn. Yeah, first of all thinking, and then inspiring thoughts, great Dharma talks, great insight, amazing thoughts you have. Everything seems to make sense, but that's not far enough yet. To where all the thoughts stop. That's amazing. So after a while, one notices that, respects it, and gets used to it. It's not boring at all. You know, sometimes people ask, when you come here, what do you do all day? Sit, meditate. Don't you get bored? At first people say, yeah. But afterwards, no. It's so wonderful, so enjoyable to do hardly anything at all. It's not boring. After 43 years of being a monk, aren't you bored? No way. Best thing in my life. Okay, it's measuring again. But, you know what I mean? It's just, oh yeah, this is good stuff. So, your tastes in enjoyment and what you really value, they do change. So, if you do get dull, yes, be respectful of dull. Don't measure it. This is par for the course. There was, this is one of the suttas, just to make sure that people understand this is real stuff. There was, the Buddha was with his attendant Ananda, and they saw a monk meditating. It's on the edge of the forest. Perfect posture. You know, his legs full lotus, back straight, right hand over the left hand, thumb slightly touching, the chin tucked in, just watching the breath. Breathing in, breathing out. Didn't move. And the Buddha turned around to his attendant Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. And a couple of weeks later, that monk had disrobed. And then he saw another monk in the middle of the forest. And he was nodding this way. And nodding that way. And nodding all over the place. Lots of sloth and torpor. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about him. And a couple of weeks later, he became alive with all the psychic powers. So I've been watching you. There's a few of you have been nodding. Another couple of weeks. And there's other people who are dead straight. Those are the ones you're worried about. Why? One is a control freak. And look, I've known many monks like that. And they don't last. On the outside, they look so perfect. But after a while, there's this one monk, he gave me his bowl when he disrobed. And I still got it. And everyone thought he was enlightened. Or pretty close, because he would never, we'd stay up all night meditating, and he would never nod at all. He was always dead straight. And then I thought, well, what was happening? I thought you had really great meditation. He said, no, it's just so much tightness, so much tension. You know, keep him, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, often I would open my eyes and look at you. You're half asleep. I was so jealous. I wish I could do that. To let go and relax and fall asleep during the meditation time. He was controlling. He didn't know how to let go. So many people are like that. So much control, so much will, so much fear, that they get so tight and tense. They get sick. They don't know how just to relax and allow the deep meditations to happen. Yeah, you go through the tiredness. You go through the dullness, but it's just par for the course. All it is, you've got low energy. And if you've got low energy, you haven't got no petrol or gas left in your car, what do? You don't keep driving at full speed, trying to sort of magically get some gas or some petrol in the car. You relax it. Let it be. This is with the mind anyway. Maybe the simile is not great. But after a while, your mind charges up. You get your energy coming up again through stillness. You've got to be really still. Not being still, I still feel dull. Come on, be still. Just like the old simile. You can't hold this still, you put it down, and it becomes still all by itself. Is it still yet? No, not yet. Come on. Come on, I haven't got all day, you know. I've only got 7 days left of my meditation retreat. Come on, get still. That's not letting go, is it? So to be let go, just be patient. Leave it alone. Be still. Don't interfere. Don't will. Don't measure. A eon, 2 eons, it'll become still eventually. So, this is what real patience is, waiting in the moment. Not waiting for something to happen. That's a different type of craving, wanting. Waiting for something to happen. When's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? When are we going to get there? When are we going to arrive? That is not patience. Patience is waiting in this moment. It's the only time you ever have. So just be here. Don't judge. Don't control. And then little by little, your mind gets more and more still. Yeah, you're dull. Stay with the dullness. Nothing wrong. You can't break any precepts when you're half asleep. So at least you're doing something good. And little by little, the dullness disappears. Don't interfere with the process. You wake up, energy starts to come in. Your mindfulness gets powerful. Now you can actually feel, you can see, you can know. And that is why when you go outside, if you make it outside of this room, and you go and see, wow, the sky is so incredibly blue, deep blue, a vivid blue, never seen a blue like that before. And just, wow, the bamboo, incredible golds and yellows and browns in there. Wow, look at all of that. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. That's William Blake, 17th century mystic, poet and artist as well. That fellow knew about some mindfulness and stillness. to see a world in a grain of sand. We pass it by too quickly because our mindfulness is not strong enough. You dull. But when you start to wake up, wow! It's amazing. Just everything is so interesting. So beautiful. Things you never thought would be beautiful before, just incredible. And I won't go into one of my favourite anecdotes, which happened here some years ago, in actually the middle toilet in the monks, in the men's quarters. But if anyone really wants to know, I'd be very happy to tell you, put it down on a piece of paper and I'll answer it this evening. I love to hear that story, it's gross. But the reason why it's gross, that there's this one fellow who works over in CERN, French guy, he said that answers so many questions, that anecdote, about the nature of beauty. It's not sort of, you know, in the object, because this was a gross object, but it looks so gorgeous. Your breath. Why is it so hard to watch the breath? You're not ready for it, that's why. And the mind is really strong. The breath is delightful. Walking meditation, it comes out. You don't have to teach you this, it just happens. You're just watching this one step, just moving it up. It's incredible, just the amount of beautiful, amazing just feelings and sensations, you know, in your body as you're moving it up. And it's sensuous, because it's sensual, and it's beautiful, it's peaceful, it just takes over your mind. It's incredible what's happening. You can't wander off. There's too much going on to give it names. And you're just really enjoying yourself, just moving your legs. Oh, this is amazing. Whatever you do becomes just so enjoyable through stillness. And you watch your breath. Oh, yeah. You can do this all day, breathing it. Wow. You're not faking it. It's natural. Now you know how you can sit for long periods of time enjoying it. But if you interrupt the process, is it still yet? That's what wastes time. Measuring. And after a while, the thinking stops. Thinking just, you don't make it stop. Making it stop means making more thinking. Come on, stop it. Stop it. The old story. Oops, I've got to stop now. 4 months, keeping a vow of silence. You know, this old one. But it's a very pertinent, because, you know, this is why people can't stop thinking. I have a vow of silence. When one monk sneezes, the first monk says, bless you. The second monk said, ha, you've just broken your vow of silence. So have you. And the fourth monk said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. You see, when you try to stop thinking, that's more thoughts. It becomes that endless. So instead, we understand what's the cause of thoughts. Wanting. So wanting to stop the thoughts just creates more thoughts. Find the cause. Wanting. Measuring. Fear. When you see those as the causes, then see if you can focus on eliminating the causes. And then you're not thinking. You're still. Natural, no force, no effort. Effort causes thoughts, doesn't stop them. Then you're peaceful. Now you've got some good insight. You've understood something. And that will take you so much deeper, all the way into the amazing enlightenment, meditation, all sorts of other stuff. So there you go. So, sadhu. Sadhu! Okay, have a nice morning, or a bad morning, don't measure it, whatever happens, it's good enough. So interviews now, those who want interviews.